the Seljuk Turks did not get near enough to Constantinople to threaten it. Then, a couple of centuries later, came the Osmanli Turks. You read about them in your history books under the name of Ottoman Turks. The dynastic founder of this nation was named Osman. You would spell it O-S-M-A-N or O-Z-M-A-N. Then apparently somebody who lived began calling it Othman. There was an earlier character named Othman, and I suppose they got the name mixed up. And then, with that satanic perversity of all ancient and medieval historians and travelers who wrote about their stuff, they weren't satisfied with calling it Othman, they called it Ottoman. No Turk would answer to that name. They have always said they were the Osmanli people. About 1250 A.D., the Osman Turks appeared near the headquarters of the Euphrates River, migrating westwardly. They settled in the lands of the Seljuk Turk Sultan Aladdin, became vassals, joined his armed forces, and adopted his banner of the crescent. Then, 1288, Osman began to conquer the eastern Asia Minor lands of the empire. It was rich and weak, and he found it easy enough to take over. By 1301, he had taken a large area clear of the Black Sea. Osman died in 1326, but his successors continued their expansion. Now the Turks, even more so than the Romans, were the soldiers par excellence. They really made a science of warfare. They quickly developed a strategy that worked. Like the Arabs, they were nomadic horsemen, so they relied principally on cavalry. Now, warfare before that time had consisted of the main bodies of the two armies rushing against each other and sticking each other with spears and chopping at each other with swords, and they got to it as directly and expeditiously as possible. Sometimes a smaller but better trained and disciplined force routed a large one. Now the Turks developed a bright idea. They had their best trained, best equipped troops kept as a reserve back at the rear. In front, they put light-armed, irregular cavalry. People who were not primarily soldiers, but simply had gotten into the army for the hope of sharing in the loot if there was victory. These were not well-disciplined, not well-trained, not very effective. And if they all got killed, it didn't lose anything to the army. So they were put out in front and sent out to attack the enemy. Well, of course, they were quickly beaten off. And they kept coming back, and they would come up close, and the enemy cavalry would charge them and drive them into headlong flight. And that was repeated several times. The enemy cavalry always drove them off without any particular difficulty. But they tired themselves out in doing so. And then when the horses and the men were tired, then these irregular cavalry Turks would run off to the sides, and the main cavalry body of the Turks, rested, fresh, would make a furious charge against the enemy, who were too tired now to keep up the battle much. And it brought the Turks victory after victory after victory. For a period of three centuries, they hardly ever lost a major battle. Another thing they developed, from about 1330 A.D., they kept a standing army. Now, up to that time, in all kingdoms, when war came, all the able-bodied men of military age were subject to being drafted into the armed forces. But they were farmers or merchants or workmen. They didn't have too much practice at military arts, and they weren't too good at it. But the Turks, from about 1330 on, raised a considerable-sized army of professional soldiers. This was their whole job. They were paid a regular salary for this. They wasted no time doing anything else. So they were constantly in training, practicing warfare. And because they were well-armed, well-trained, they were, of course, tremendously effective, and it was very difficult for untrained forces to stand up to them. Now, this was a full century before the first use of a professional standing army appeared in Europe. You can't say much for the Turkish morals or kindness or anything of that sort, but you do have to give them credit for being effective soldiers. And incidentally, during the Korean War, the Turks sent a small contingent of soldiers over there to help us, and they were probably the most effective troops on our side. You notice that while Russia shoots down our airplanes and steals our Navy ships and so on, they don't fire a shot at the Turks. The Turks would shoot back. Now, another thing that developed at this time, peculiar to the Turks, you have heard of these troops under the name of Janissaries. Of course, the name in Turkish was Yeniceri, new troops. But as I say, there is that satanic disposition to always change and garble things till they're unrecognizable. The Turks had conquered quite a number of Christian towns, and they were wondering what to do. If they let them alone, there might, of course, be rebellion against their rule. So, by way of both strengthening the Turkish forces and weakening the conquered, they took 1,000, at least, each year, of Christian children, the very cream of the boys of 8 to 12 years old. They were taken by force from their parents, converted to Mohammedanism, and right from the start, put under military training. Strict discipline, learned to undergo hardship, they became tough and hardy, and while it was rough going and strict discipline, on the other hand, the pay was good and promotion came quickly to one who really put his mind to it and showed the makings of a good soldier. So they relied upon these Janissaries as among their picked troops. Of course, they didn't see they were doing anything wrong in that. They said, well, you know how today we say it's our missionary duty to convert the heathen to Christianity. They said it's our duty to convert all unbelievers to Mohammedanism. So we're doing the kids a favor. During the time that the use of these Janissary troops were continued here, some 3 centuries, it's been estimated that a full 500,000 Christian children were thus kidnapped and made into Turkish soldiers. Now, the Arabs had moved out to conquer lands primarily for the purpose of converting the conquered to Mohammedanism. They, of course, followed the custom of all armies in doing a certain amount of looting when they captured a place. And that isn't entirely ancient. Talk to anybody who was in the American army that invaded Germany and see the cameras and binoculars and such things that he stole from the inhabitants while he was there. So these aren't customs of the ancient past alone. Now the Turks, while they were Mohammedans, were not primarily interested in the spread of the Mohammedan religion. They were primarily interested in conquering and ruling these other lands. They wanted to be the masters, supporting themselves simply by fighting and on the tribute taxes that they could collect. The Arabs, by their tremendously effective armed forces, did succeed in spreading their dominion, but they did very little about organizing it into an effective kingdom. The Turks, on the other hand, instead of trying to see how fast they could spread, they'd move on 50 to 100 miles, taking that much new territory, and then for 20 or 30 years they'd stop there while they completed their consolidation of their conquests and got it thoroughly organized and made sure everybody knew just who was boss now in these conquered lands. They were out to rule. In 1356, the Turks gained their first foothold on the European side of the Hellespont. Now, the main portion of the city of Constantinople is on the European side. The portion on the Turkish side is called Scutari. Asia Minor was pretty largely in the hands of the Turks, and now they had moved over onto the European side. In 1361, they captured the quite important city of Adrianople, and that finally brought some alarm in Constantinople. As far as regaining their provinces from the Turks was concerned, they never gave it a thought. They knew it was hopeless. They couldn't regain them from the Arabs as far as that goes. They were a beaten people, contented to live within their city of Constantinople and just hoping they'd be left at peace, the former empire. So from 1361, when the Turks captured Adrianople, the emperors at Constantinople lived in utter dread of the Turks and were always very conciliatory in trying to enter into treaties with the Turks by which they could be guaranteed that the Turks wouldn't attack Constantinople. Now you remember there had been a split 1,000 years earlier than this between the Roman Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox Church. Nevertheless, Constantinople, while it was the seat of the Greek Orthodox Church, they had lost their outlying empire. They were in danger of losing the city they had left, and they didn't have military strength enough to defend themselves effectively. They couldn't hope for rescue by any Asiatic power. The only hope was from the Christian nations of Europe. Now, the period of the Crusades was past. The Christian nations had spent a great deal of money and lost a great many lives in the Crusades. They were not in the mood to renew it, particularly because all the European Christian nations were in a period of general internal disorder about this time. One factor that might hope to induce the European nations to go on a new crusade and send some forces to defend Constantinople would be if the Pope could stir them up to do it. So the Emperor kept intriguing, trying to gain the support of the Pope. He became very subservient to the Pope, where before there'd been no love lost at all. And by this, as it became known, the Emperor lost the support of the Greek portion of his population, who were very much attached to their church, corrupt though it was. And in fact, the patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church at this time said, I would rather see the Turks in Constantinople than to see the Pope's power restored here. So they were really in a rather bad way. The Turks, meantime, were vigorously pushing their conquests on into the Balkan countries. In 1389, they absorbed Bulgaria. They brought their frontier to the Danube. Serbia became a vassal state. They hadn't put in Turkish governors, but the king of Serbia had to swear allegiance to them and that he would raise an army and fight with them in time of, that is on the Turkish side, in time of war. And as a matter of fact, for the rest of his life he did so and furnished them with very effective troops. In 1394, they finally managed to get together a very minor sort of a crusade. About 12,000 knights, some 8,000 of them from France and the remainder from Germany and Hungary, marched down to the Danube to fight the Turks and drive them back out of Europe. Well, now, war was definitely a business to the Turks, and they were thoroughly businesslike. But these knights, vain, arrogant, boastful, and stupid, they said, why, these Turks are no match for us. One of them boasted, if the sky fell, we'd hold it up on the points of our lances. So, when they got to the point where it was probably only going to be a day or two's march to make contact with the Turkish forces, and they stopped in what seemed like a favorable place to meet the Turks there, beside the Danube, instead of making proper preparations, fortifying the place and all that, they just spent their time in riotous drinking and carousing until suddenly they were roused by scouts coming back with the word, well, the Turks are just over the hill in the next valley. The whole Turkish army coming. Well, they formed up in lines for battle, and the king of Hungary was a sensible man. He wanted to do this in a reasonable and sensible way. But these French knights were so vain and boastful and arrogant, they wouldn't be told how they were going to fight. They wanted to go out and just mop up these Turks like that. So these 8,000 French knights attacked this Turkish army of 40,000. Now the Turks were drawn up in their typical way. On the far side of the hill over in the next valley was the main body of the Turks. Then out in front of that they sent this light irregular cavalry. So these French knights charged them, and they had a grand time defeating and driving them into flight, and got themselves thoroughly tired and their horses tired out. So they chased the retreating Turkish light cavalry up over the hill, and just beyond them lay the main body of the Turkish army. Well, the Turkish forces had been drawn in more or less of a crescent form. So immediately these two wings rushed out, attacking the French on the flanks and closing in back of them so they couldn't retreat. Practically all of the French knights were either killed on the field of battle or captured, and the prisoners were practically all massacred the next day by the Turks. They paid for their stupidity. But the defeat, the total destruction of this 8,000-man contingent out of a force of only 12,000 to begin with, sent the rest of them back in panic flight. So that attempt to drive the Turks out of Europe failed miserably. The Turks moved on, occupied Greece and southern Hungary. Now remember what they had taken of the old Roman Empire, taken then and a bit later took. They had Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia. They eventually penetrated into Austria to the point where they besieged the city of Vienna. And eventually, after some 25 years of fighting, they took Albania on the Dalmatian coast. And of course, south from that, they had Macedonia and Greece. So as you can see now, the Turks had taken every inch of the remaining Eastern Roman Empire, except the small area containing the city of Constantinople and a few miles outside of it. Then the Turks moved up to besiege Constantinople. They were bought off by payment of a large annual tribute, and the emperor turned one church into a mosque. That was part of the terms the Turks required of him. So after getting their first year's tribute payment, the Turks went back and started to besiege it again, and at that time, the Turks suddenly found their hands full with another thing, and they had to give up any attempt to go after Constantinople. You had the great invasion of Tamerlane. He was a Mongol, head of a vast group of nomadic Mongol horsemen. In other words, the same sort of thing you had 1,000 years earlier under the Huns, Attila the Hun. His name, Timur, meant iron, and he was called Leng, meaning the lame. So Timur Leng was corrupted into Tamerlane by the Europeans who wrote about him. His capital was in Samarkand, and he was quite ambitious. He declared he was going to be ruler of the entire inhabited earth. And he set out to do it, and he got a surprising amount of it, too. In his 36-year reign, he conquered all the area from the Great Wall of China to the center of Russia, and southeast of that to the sources of the Ganges River, India, westward to the Mediterranean and the River Nile. That's quite a large accomplishment for that brief time. Like all the Mongols, he was extremely cruel. Historians have said that he caused more misery and killed more people than any one person who had ever lived in all history. When he captured a city, he generally massacred most or all of the population. He used to chop off heads and pile these heads up into a huge pyramid outside the city walls. So when he began invading the Turkish kingdom, why, they really had trouble on their hands. Now, I've mentioned how stupid the Roman emperors were, but some of these Turkish sultans were as bad. Sultan Bayezid, who led his Turkish army of some 120,000 men out in 1402 to meet Tamerlane. Tamerlane had an army of, well, you can conservatively say 500,000 men. Some of the ancient historians called it as much as 800,000, but it's an exaggeration because the land couldn't have supported them. They couldn't have furnished the food and other supplies, but probably 500,000 men. These Turks, remember now, for 3 centuries had been winning substantially every battle they fought. So they were conceited and arrogant. Sultan Bayezid was very much of a hunter. The way he liked to hunt was to take some of his troops out and have them form a great circle around an area containing game. He would go into the middle of it, and his troops would march through this area toward the center, driving the game before him, until finally, as the animals were driven up to where he was, why, the Sultan could shoot them with bow and arrow. So he brought his forces out to where he was on one side of a valley, and the Mongol forces were on the other side, a few miles apart. There was a small stream that ran into the valley from the side where the Turks were. So, with that to furnish them water, he set up his camp there, deposited all his supplies of food and whatever other supplies they had. Then, to show his contempt for the Mongols across the way, he led his army out into the hills beyond the valley and spent the better part of a day hunting, tiring out his men, of course, the way they had to go beat the bushes to drive out the game. When he came back to his camp with his tired out, thirsty army, the Mongols had taken his camp and all his food supply. They held the only water supply for his thirsty troops. Worn out, thirsty, hungry, his Turkish army had to give battle to the Mongols. And, of course, they were practically exterminated by the Mongols. Well, Tamerlane decided this didn't offer enough prospect of worthwhile conquest for him. As I say, he'd already carried his forces clear through to the Mediterranean coast, and the Sultan down in Egypt, having insulted him, he sent forces down there to defeat the Egyptians. So Tamerlane turned back to the east. He was going to conquer China. He already had everything north of the Great Wall, and he was going to take the rest of it. And he died in 1405. If it hadn't been for that, why, of course, not only all Western Asia, but quite possibly Europe as well, would have been under the Mongol rule. Well, in 1442 to 1444, the Serbians, Hungarians, Albanians, and Poles got together a considerable army, almost drove the Turks out of Europe, but were finally defeated, and the Turkish grip on Europe was complete. That is, the Balkan part of Europe. So in 1453, the Turks besieged Constantinople. Now this was the first large-scale and effective use of heavy artillery to batter down city walls in all history. And Constantinople had been practically impregnable with those great high stone walls. Of course, the Greeks and Romans had the ballista, a sort of catapult with which to throw big stones, but those were useless against heavy stone walls like that. You could throw them over the wall, hoping to hit somebody inside the city, but you couldn't batter down walls. But the Turks had big cannon, and they fired these heavy cannonballs that smashed the stone of the walls till finally they could crumble a wall clear down to the ground. I brought here a little book, Marvels of Prophecy, by Howard Rand, because I want you to see the illustration on the front of it. It is one of these old Turkish cannon. It's in the form of an animal. It sits on its haunches, head up, four legs on the ground, and the mouth of the thing is, of course, the muzzle of the cannon. Now, as you see it here, a tampon, a plug, is inserted in the mouth of it so that rainwater won't collect in the thing and rust it out. But I want you to look at this and see what this thing looks like, and then you're going to understand some of these things that John was talking about here. The heads of the horses were as the heads of lions. You notice that this cannon thing is in the form of what's recognizably intended to be a lion. And out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone, that is sulfur. Well, now, black powder was the only explosive they had in those days, common black gunpowder. And black gunpowder is a mixture of potassium nitrate and powdered charcoal and sulfur. So smoke and brimstone or sulfur was spouted out of the mouths of these cannon when they were fired. By these three was the third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issues out of their mouths. Now, the Turks were the first ones, as I say, who learned to make effective use of artillery. And they went in for it in the big scale. They not only had these great heavy siege guns with which to batter down the walls, but they also developed the use of smaller, easily moved field guns, which were used in warfare on the battlefield. You see, if you stuff a few pounds of pebbles and cobblestones and so on into one of those cannon and fire it, you've got what is in effect a gigantic shotgun, and it just sweeps a terrific swath through enemy troops out in front. And the Turks, as I say, being the professional soldiers par excellence, they had learned to do this, and with their cannon they inflicted quite a number of terrible defeats on the opposing Christian armies. But battering the walls of Constantinople, the siege lasted some 7 weeks. They opened a great breach in the walls through which the Turkish army was able to drive into the city. Now, they tremendously outnumbered the defending forces. The emperor had, probably 10 to 12,000 good, well-trained professional soldiers. And, of course, for the rest, everybody who could handle a sword or a spear was there trying to defend his life, but they weren't trained in effective forces. The Turks lost heavily, but they were able to force their way through the breach in the walls and take Constantinople. So the last trace of the Roman Empire disappeared with the fall of Constantinople in 1453 A.D. Now, note something about the time. You remember these angels who were bound in the river Euphrates, and we pick up the movements of both of the Turkish forces around the headwaters of the Euphrates. They were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year. Well, on the prophetic scale, a year, 360 days, that would be 360 years. A month, 30 days, that would be 30 years. 360 and 30, that's 390. A day makes it 391, and the hour would be a fraction of a year. So 391 years was the time that John gave for the duration of the aggressive phase of this Turkish woe. All right. In the year 1062, the Seljuk Turks, the first wave of the Turkish invasion, crossed the Euphrates River, moving westwardly into Syria and Asia Minor. Add 391 years to that, and you get 1453, which is the date of the fall of Constantinople, and the final extinguishment of the last trace of the Roman Empire. So not only the nature of what was to happen, but the exact duration of it had been prophesied by John, writing somewhere between 94 and 96 A.D. Now, the book of Revelation is not easy to understand. It's all in symbols. If you won't study the Bible enough to learn what the symbols mean, you can't make head or tail of it. And the average bartender knows pretty near as much about the Bible as the average preacher. The preacher can spot him about 50 verses is all. And that's why you find very few preachers venturing to talk about the book of Revelation. They say, oh, it's a sealed book. But you remember John was told, seal not the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. But when you dig into this enough to know what it's talking about, the inspiration of it becomes unmistakable. This sort of thing simply could not have been written from any source except divine inspiration.